Well, as Doug said, I'm going to give what I, by my count, is the third seminar on Lyman continuum polarization. I guess to relativists, the Lyman continuum is in the optical, but to an observer, I guess, it is in the ultraviolet.
Well, high redshift, high redshift.
Oh, I see. I take it back. All right. I'll probably go fast in the introduction here, although there are some people who were not present for probably either of the two earlier talks on the same thing, so I'll show some data briefly.
For that reason, maybe I should also make my disclaimer again.
About whether the facts, whether the data, okay, let me get it up there, and then you can make that disclaimer. Which you did very eloquently, both sides, in the talk just a week ago. For quasar luminosities, if standard accretion disk efficiencies are of any interest, are of any guide, and 10% efficiencies in order of magnitude, if the Eddington limit is any guide, or now if you simply fall back onto the observed masses of black holes in galactic nuclei, you may be talking about a solar mass a year accreting onto a 10 to the 8th solar mass black hole. And if this goes through a thin standard disk, then you have effective temperatures at the hottest inner part of the disk, which are like O-star temperatures. And therefore, the Lyman edge might be an expected feature, not yet speaking of polarization, but total flux. And there's been a spirited discussion of that whole issue that was well reviewed by Eric Agol in his talk in late February here at the workshop, which is on the web. And I don't propose to repeat all that, but to jump right into the polarization issue, models for the accretion disk atmosphere, starting with fairly simple ones by Ari Lauer and company around 1990, predicted that you might have a diminished polarization in the Lyman continuum region compared to the already weak observed polarization in optical wavelengths due to the fact that the bound free opacity of hydrogen would be competing with electron scattering at those wavelengths, and you would get less polarization due to electron scattering. This leaves aside the whole issue of whether the polarization in the optical really is due to electron scattering. For example, is it in fact orthogonal to what you might expect from electron scattering? Motivated, at least in part by that, efforts were made to use the Hubble Space Telescope and the spectropolarimeter on the faint object spectrograph to measure polarization in quasars with sufficient redshifts to look beyond the Lyman edge. The Hubble Space Telescope is desirable not only because you need a lower redshift object, but because the lower redshift in general means that things are less mucked up with the Lyman alpha forest at the interesting wavelengths. The result of this was to discover not a drop in the polarization, but rather a dramatic rise in the polarization. And the most extreme example of this is PG 1630 plus 377. This is one of a set of objects which were already picked out on the basis of IUE observations as having a hint that the flux, not the polarization, but the total flux, was dropping off in the Lyman continuum region. This made them, therefore, so-called candidate Lyman edge quasars to be an example of the expected accretion disk absorption edge that you would at least expect for relatively cool AGN disks. Given the range of parameters, you might have 100,000 degree maximum temperature in a disk, or you might have only a few tens of thousands. And in that cooler range, I think models still agree, even the sophisticated ones with and non-LTE effects and so on, that you would expect for sufficiently cool disks an absorption edge at the Lyman edge. But due to the fact that this is coming from stuff that's orbiting the black hole at a goodly fraction of the speed of light, you might expect it to be extremely Doppler broadened, and therefore you're really looking not for anything you would recognize as an edge in this stellar spectroscopy game, but rather a change of slope. And these were some objects that had at least some suggestion of that. This one here, this is observed wavelength. The red shift is, I think, 1.6. And so this is where the Lyman edge would be in the observed frame. And I would guess that this hint of a change of slope around that wavelength is what was motivating the observations. And it is not... And that kind of gentle change of slope is of the character of what the models such as my own student Howard Coleman and a number of other workers have found is all you should get observationally if you had a pretty sharp Lyman edge in the actual disk itself due to the broadening. So when this set of a few of these candidate Lyman edge quasars were observed in polarization, one saw this dramatic rise. Here is the percent polarization in Q and U, and most of the action in this object is in U, but you can see stuff going up to of order 20% with non-trivial error bars. And if you plot not exactly the polarized flux, which would be P times F lambda, but rather the Stokes flux, which is something that Ski has articulated the benefits of. Specifically, it's not positive definite. I think that's the main argument. So it, with its statistical errors, it can bounce up and down below zero, and so you don't have the polarization bias to worry about. And what you see is a polarized Lyman alpha line, which has not probably received the attention it deserves in relation to the subject of interest, which is this rise in polarization, which is happening not at the Lyman edge wavelength, but rather about 750 angstroms rest wavelength, which has been one of the motivating issues here. In fact, the whole issue has been, going back to this paper and the nearly simultaneous one on another object by Impey et al., this is suspiciously close to the Lyman edge, but it's not at the Lyman edge. Is it to do with the atomic physics of hydrogen, or is it a coincidence? And interestingly, yes, you could argue that it, which would be about, yeah, you could argue that it's starting to get going at the edge. Yeah, right here, and so translating that over to this picture. Yeah. Okay, so those are the facts. The disclaimer is that there aren't a lot of confirming observations. In fact, it's only been seen with this instrument. There are a couple of other objects that show it with this instrument, but I'm not aware of any other instrument, any ground-based instrument doing this at high redshift or anything like that to confirm this. And we understand there is unpublished, what is it? Well, I don't know to call it broad or narrow band, but filter band imaging in polarimetry that seemed to show what an increased flux, but a decreased polarization, at least in a percentage sense.
Right, and the polarization decrease might be consistent with zero. I think that I haven't gotten the data yet from my collaborators, but I know that it's way down from
okay.
what it was.
Okay.
And just to put a little more perspective on it, since all this energy is going into it, the reasons to believe the data are that they looked really healthy, it's an instrumental cue in you, and no anomaly like that has ever been reported in any other polarimetry. People have done a lot of interstellar work and null standards and so on with the HST, and it's simply never done anything like that. And the experts, including Goodrich and Rich Allen and Anurata, say there's no way there could be that much scattered light bouncing around in that spectrograph. And so Anurata totally believes it, thinks it's totally robust. I was skeptical just because it was so weird. And we looked at the carbon-4 for polarization, and there was none. And we thought Flamanop is polarized, maybe carbon-4 is. And so that means that if the result is right, the phenomenon went away in the meantime. And then we went and looked in broadband in the UV with FOC, another instrument. And then, as I say, the polarization was certainly not consistent with this. Mm-hmm. So maybe it went away, or maybe it's wrong.
It's wrong.
So carbon-4 is not polarized.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What about low res V? When that comes online, will that be able to do polarimetry?
I don't know. Does anyone
know? Cohen's polarimeter onto that.
Oh, the blue side of lower.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And that's, it will be able to do that.
And so what wavelength?
Oh, I imagine pretty close to the atmospheric cutoff.
300 or thereabouts.
Yeah. But I don't even think that's necessary. The LIC system is now good enough that you could do this in many objects in LIC. The LIC UV system is now great. So we just need a volunteer. Mm-hmm. You don't really need tech.
Mm. Well, you integrate for much.
What's that?
You integrate for a very long time.
It's not that bad. You know, I published a paper on late polarization of high Z quasars.
Yeah.
And with the terrible UV system that they had, you know, the errors in the Lyman continuum were still just a few percent. With the new system, I think they get down to 1 or 2% in an hour or two for many objects, I think. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
And Ski referred to the energy that's going into this, and that is an interesting sociological phenomenon. I think the reason is, and I hope to give you an example, whether or not you think it's the truth, of the kind of potential that might come out of this feature. Basically, we've been desperate for any kind of spectral feature that might give us a handle on accretion disks in quasars. And this, along with the iron K-alpha, are, to my mind, the only two games in town. So it seemed that the potential was high enough that it was worth pursuing all this. Yes.
So why haven't you seen it in anything else?
There are several others that show qualitatively the same thing, just not as spectacular.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One published by another group.
Yeah, which I'll show in a minute.
Can I just one other more recent FSC observation that you guys did? Anurata claims that the spectrum did vary, or that no, that the bus varied, that this was an interesting state, right? But do you have any... Is there still a bottom edge there? You
don't know. Okay. I don't think we know that. I do know that I think it's pretty unusually variable. The flux in that with HST was different from, was lower than IUE by a factor of 4. So conceivably in the low state you see something.
Well, as to explanations, I got things perhaps a little out of chronological order here, but as I was struggling with some crazy jet-type models for this thing involving a blue shift, which I quickly abandoned, there came in the mail a paper by Omer and Eric Agal, which was one of the moments of mixed exhilaration and jealousy that I will never forget, because they came up with what was a very pretty and seemingly natural stellar atmosphere phenomenon that would look like this. And it seemed that it might really work. It might then really realize the potential of tying this to an accretion disk and convince us perhaps that we really did have thin disks after all. This is the data on a different object called PG1222+228 that I will return to later from a completely different angle. But here is the flux in F lambda, and this is again rest wavelength, but from the theoretical models you can see just where the Lyman edge would be, and they were able to fit things. But these models, as you can see from the sharp edge, have not been fed through the relativistic transfer function, so they haven't been Doppler broadened or anything due to the disk rotation. And here is the polarization, and what you can see for a modest effective temperature, which is about like 25,000 degrees, you've got a nice Lyman edge and absorption together with this remarkable rise in polarization to the blue side of the edge. And while you can perhaps debate whether it jumps up quite as abruptly as these observations of this object do, it is certainly nevertheless remarkably suggestive that something that is a straightforward consequence of atmospheric physics would do this. And it's quite easy to explain. I don't want to dwell on it in any length because we're going to move on to alternative interpretations. But basically, the polarization is due to electron scattering in the atmosphere. And when you cross the Lyman edge, you first get a little drop in polarization due to the predominance of absorption opacity, but to shorter wavelengths then, the electron scattering opacity comes back because the absorption opacity goes as 1 over nu cubed. But more importantly, perhaps, as you get to shorter wavelengths, you're getting to a wavelength that's down on the exponentially falling part of the black body function, as a result of which the brightness temperature is a strong function of depth, or rather the brightness you see is a strong function of depth, which gives you strong limb darkening. And as we discussed last time, limb darkening is the formula to get electron scattering to translate into strong polarization. So it's a very pretty effect, very natural.
But
wonderful.
Since it has to be cool, it doesn't make any ionizing continuum photons.
That's right. It will be a very weak ionizing source, and certainly helium-2 or any of the higher ions would have to result from the power law. The power law that you observe showing up in X-rays and which... in my exhilaration, I immediately started following this up, ran my own simple atmospheric calculations, which confirmed the atmospheric effect, and then ran it through the relativistic transfer code that I was fortunate to have courtesy of Svi Piran and Ari Lehor, which just does the sums if you inject a spectrum as a function of radius in annular rings. It will do all the Doppler shifts and photon bending and gravitational redshifts and all that. And the result of all that was that if you look, this top panel is flux. And by the way, I will just say one thing on the total flux. This curvature here, which is related to it being a Lyman edge candidate object, I cannot fit that with a disk that is a black body at every radius. I cannot get it to bend over fast enough. It's too broad. And on the other hand, if I have an edge, either an atmospheric edge as was in these models, or just a toy edge where you drop it by some reasonable amount at the Lyman edge, then you can bend it over. So there is a suggestion, assuming that possibilities involving reddening don't need to be worried about, and I'm not sure that's true. But setting that aside, I think there is an argument to be made that at least in these objects, you really do need a Lyman edge to get that kind of curvature in the flux. But unfortunately, the polarization rise is shifted badly to the blue. This is an accretion disk. It's a Schwarzschild disk following their own lead, but to my surprise, the rise in polarization was shifted quite a bit to shorter wavelengths than the observed rise. Now this is, we're back to PG 1630 plus 377 here, not the object that they fit. Quite apart from it being too weak, it was badly blue shifted, and I sort of puzzled over that and wondered why the stellar atmosphere effect itself was happening at the about the right wavelength for the rise. So why was the thing not, I might have imagined it would be badly blended, badly Doppler broadened, ramping up across the edge. But to be shifted like that was a puzzle.
Let's see, where are we compared? 6 degrees off the plane
or something? In this mu of 0.1,
yeah.
So I guess that's about right. We're assuming here that to get a strong polarization like that, if we're dealing with a cylindrically symmetric thing, you better be close to the plane.
Yeah.
Now, that could lead into the whole question of whether dust tori do or do not exist in luminous quasars, and that's another discussion. All right. Here, that's because of the helium-1 edge. The helium-1 edge comes in and its opacity overwhelms electron scattering, and there's a helium-2 edge as well. But there's no flux out there. And this thing is only going to happen when there's declining flux because of the need to have the source function gradient. All right. And things can be said about rotation angles. This is a Schwarzschild one. There's an arbitrary rotation. We don't know the orientation of the thing, so... you can see in Schwarzschild there's practically no rotation, but at shorter wavelengths in a Kerr model, as you'll see, there are strong rotations due to the fact that the shortest wavelength stuff comes the hottest innermost radii, and that is a potential diagnostic.
None of those position angles, the red at the edge, mean anything. Those error bars are missing.
The error bars are... All right, well, I wasn't planning to make anything of them,
good.
But
that's totally misleading.
It probably should be binned.
It wouldn't help. I mean, there's nothing there. And,
all right.
And it's the, you know, the nature of the error in sigma that the entire 180 is within 2 sigma.
All right. Anyway, so there was a problem. Now, there is a model that I will return to discuss later that, quite honestly, has not gained huge following out in the community, at least of AGN observers, but I'm wondering today, in the last week, I've begun to wonder if it will yet have the last laugh, or the authors will have the last laugh, having to do with line scattering in an outflow of the nature of a broad absorption line outflow in QSO, and I'll return to that later, skip over it for now, but that was Lee and Blanford. This is the first paper with the concept, and then a paper a year later by Lee and Blanford that developed detail. This one is not. And we'll return to all that. So I mentioned that one now. And then I went on in a way that was motivated by this problem of having shifted Omer's rise too far to the blue, and I came up with kind of a toy model, a completely ad hoc model that has the ability to fit the data, but no physics whatsoever. And what I did simply as an exercise, I got curious to see how much shift you were going to get just from the relativity, separating it from what the atmosphere effects would do. And so I just put a toy model that had a just a postulated sharp increase in polarization at the Lyman edge in the rest frame of the orbiting gas. So at 912, the polarization goes from essentially nothing to some arbitrary value.
And stays up.
And so the stuff is orbiting here, and you might have expected that the receding stuff would give the observer some redshifted, you know, redshift this, and then only at the highest frequencies would you start to have the entire disk be sending you radiation that's strongly polarized. So I might have expected a ramp like this. Instead, what I got was a shift. More or less, to blue shift the polarization rise, but leave it not quite a step function, but a pretty steep rise. And so here are some toy models that do that. So this thing has still, I have to postulate, an edge in absorption, which in this toy model is just motivated by simple boundary temperature considerations for a simple gray atmosphere. That's all it is. So it's not arbitrary, but close to it. But more to the point is simply that the polarization rise does not happen at 912 angstroms rest wavelength. It does not ramp up starting to the red and continuing on to the blue, but rather it is displaced to the blue. Now this puzzled me a great deal. It would not have puzzled Eric, who understood exactly what was going on here. I'm sorry, you want
to? Then you can talk for a minute. Now that I've interrupted you. If you really want to take the relativistic effects seriously, then there's also a rotation in the plane of polarization.
Correct.
Was that in there?
Yes.
That's in there too.
And in the bottom plane, there they are. And in some models, they're more than this. But let's just see if we have some illustrations as we go on. But there are rotations, and those were first raised, that I recall, by Connors, Perron, and Stark.
Connors and Stark.
In the context of SIGX-1 type X-ray sources. But the idea is that you do get rotations, and because the hottest stuff is near the center, and that's where the most rotation would be, you might have a frequency-dependent rotation of the polarization plane. But in the context of meaningless thetas, why, we're not at the point observationally where we can bring that to bear. Okay, so why is it happening? Well, here, what this is a ring. And I think this ring emits at 912 angstroms in the rest frame. And I'm sorry, it says in the paper that what radius this is, but it's of order 10 RG. Just a narrow annulus emitting. And so azimuth around that annulus translates into velocity and therefore into wavelength, but the front and the back disk are two different portions. So the radiation you're receiving from the back side of the disk is the solid, and from the front side of the disk is the dotted. And here's the intensity, here's the polarization of that radiation, and here's theta. So what's happening here is that you don't get much radiation, particularly from the front side of the disk, at redshifted velocities, presumably just because of Doppler beaming away from you. You get plenty at blue-shifted velocities because of the Doppler beaming towards you. But the interesting thing is that at unredshifted velocities, the overwhelming majority of the light is coming to you from the back side of the disk because of gravitational lensing, so to speak. Now, you can see that the polarization of the radiation, which was just assumed to have a polarization of, I think this is probably Chandra's Ekar, but it doesn't matter. It's all just the relative variation of the polarization. So it's about 8% in the rest frame of the gas, and that more or less comes across in the radiation received from the front side of the disk, but the radiation received from the back side of the disk is strongly depolarized at zero velocity. And that is a combination of effects, as near as I can tell, of the fact that the radiation from the backside of the disk leaves at a more vertical angle and is then bent over the disk. Because it leaves at a more vertical angle, it is less strongly polarized to begin with. I'm guessing the stronger effect, however, is one that involves just position-dependent rotations of the polarization plane of that radiation, and therefore there's a cancellation, kind of a gravitational Faraday depolarization. So basically what that illustrates is that you get lots of light at zero velocity, but it is light lens from the backside of the disk, and it is depolarized. When you sum things up, therefore, you don't get much redshifted polarized radiation from the edge because it's beamed away from you. You don't get much polarized radiation at zero Doppler shift because it's depolarized from the lens backside of the disk. And finally, you get polarized radiation only at approaching the extreme blue shifts, because then it's coming to you and beamed to you. And so you get this interesting phenomenon, which says that in total flux, you might Doppler broaden the edge more or less the way you would intuitively expect, but in polarized flux, you would instead displace the rise to the blue and then have it come up pretty abruptly. And so you can see here, as a function of model parameters, you can get a pretty nice fit to the observed polarization rise. So the strength of that is that you get a nice natural explanation of the fact that this is coming on to the blue of the edge and then coming up pretty abruptly. In addition, the observations seem to call for a change of slope in the total flux that resembles a Doppler-broadened Lyman edge. But both the observations and the theory predict that it would be broadened right through the edge, not displaced in total flux. So that combination of things is perhaps nice.
Viewing angle?
Yes, coming to that. It is degenerate to viewing angle, but let me first comment that the potential interest here is I've shown these models as a function of the angular momentum of the black hole in dimensionless units, which goes from 0 to 1. These models simply assume kind of a black body flux with an artificial edge where the temperature is given by known physics as a function of radius. You can look that up in Novikov and Thorne. So the effective temperature is not arbitrary once you pick an M and an M dot. The M dot over M squared gets the effective temperature at the hottest part, and that's tuned to fit this turnover. But other than that, and of course the M dot to fix the total luminosity. So the A's here correspond, you can see there's the least shift for a Schwarzschild hole and increasing shifts for increasing angular momentum. That's simply because the inner edge of the disk gets to smaller radii in gravitational units for a more rapidly rotating hole. Therefore, these effects are stronger. So in principle, then, you would have a diagnostic of the spin of the hole. And that would be very useful because in chatting with Roger, the only thing that's on the table right now to measure black hole spins are the iron K-alpha fits, which the assertion there being that you see huge redshifts that require something more than a more rapidly spinning hole can't be fit with a Schwarzschild hole. There is a counter-argument by Bigelman. Reynolds and Bigelman.
Yeah. Oh,
so
you've also had the QPOs as well. I think that's
said
on the table.
All right, yeah.
The burden of proof is
Thank you. Okay, so there is that picture. And as to tilt...
Can I throw something?
Yes, sir.
There's the Lyman alpha polarization. Of course, you have to account for it. But I also should have said in the... pros and cons of the believability that the fact that Lyman alpha shows up in polarization in a polarized flux means that, like Anurata and Bob, think that anything that happens in the instrument, like scattered light thing, wouldn't know about the location of the Lyman-Alpha line.
Right.
So they feel that that means that if something went wrong, it wasn't in the instrument.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. One thing, we've heard from two different speakers at the workshop about the possibility of torques exerted by magnetic fields connected with matter plunging in from the innermost stable orbit. That would affect the dissipation and the power radiated per unit surface area. We're not talking about emission of any magnitude inside the plunge radius, but the torques would be exerted on the inner edge of the disk, as we have thought of it up to now, increasing the flux, especially near the inner edge. And I think that is would also be reflected in these things, because that would shift the centroid of the Lyman-continuum emission to a smaller radius for a fixed angular momentum. And I'm guessing that that would make, if I took a Schwarzschild hole and put in a strong dose of this inner edge torque, I'm guessing it would shift it about like A of 0.5. The reason for that is just that the innermost edge shifts to about 4 RG from 6 RG in that case. And I mean to run some cases just to see how much that is. So there might also be some diagnostic value there, although the more things it's sensitive to, the harder it is to sort out. Finally, just to mention the issue of tilt. I'm afraid this shift also depends on tilt. Here, for a maximally rotating black hole, at least what we called maximally until this new inner edge torque thing came up, is you can see as a function of mu of 0.5, 0.25, and 0.1, why the more edge on one, not surprisingly, has the greater shift in the polarization. So there is a degeneracy between angular momentum and tilt. I should say I've normalized all these things in degree of polarization. So to look at mu of 0.5 requires a very large, nearly 100% polarization in the rest frame of the gas. So in practice, you might argue that a strongly polarized object like 1630 has to be viewed fairly edge-on, in which case you may recover the ability to say something about angular momentum. Okay, and finally, and I won't say anything about it because we just had a talk on it last week, but there's this new and creative model by Bellabardoff and Putanen who suggest that Compton scattering in a corona or outflowing wind due to of radiation coming from an underlying accretion disk atmosphere with a strong absorption edge can scatter radiation into the Lyman continuum region where you otherwise don't have much radiation. And so the radiation you see there is the scattered radiation, and the twice or more scattered radiation should have substantial polarization. And Omer and I have been using his scattering code to kind of reproduce those results and seem pretty well to agree with their results, but there is some question about the polarized flux. In fact, here from our run on the wind, their wind model, although to first glance the polarization and the total flux seem to do interesting things, the polarized flux shows a rather gentle rise. We haven't explored all possibilities for parameters, but we're wondering if this is a little discouraging for that model. On the other hand, that model has physics, and the toy model that I had had no physics, so I'm in the market for anyone who has an idea how to produce the sharp edge at the Lyman edge in the gas.
And just to be careful as well, I mean, the original Plato-Mandel model also did not produce a polarized flux, right? It just produced a maximum degree of polarization.
Okay, so thank you. It's hard to do, yeah.
So I don't.
It's very hard to do. All right. I now want to move on to another object and wonder whether this object, which has up to now been discussed in the same vein as these other objects. It's one of the classic polarization rise QSOs, may nevertheless be something rather different, which may tie back to Roger's approach. PG-1222 plus 228 is the object that I showed with the Blaze and Agall model. It's a radio quiet QSO like all of these guys with an emission redshift of 2 and various narrow absorption lines systems at various redshifts. It has a polarization rise that you saw, but interestingly that polarization rise in this object coincides with a rather sharp drop in the flux. So this, no one claims that this has anything to do with an accretion disk, this sharp drop. What they must be talking about there is more or less a change of slope ramping down like this, or maybe this feature that put it on the list to be observed as a candidate Lyman edge object. This sharp drop was attributed by the authors, MP et al., to a intervening Lyman edge absorber. High redshift quasars typically go through a number of clouds, not only the Lyman alpha forest, but a number of galaxies or galactic halos with metal line systems. And there are observed these lines. I didn't clutter the figure with a lot of drawing, but these are all identified. This one right here, and a close pair here, and this one as Lyman alpha lines, and there are supporting identifications of other lines or metals, so I don't really dispute that. And this one in particular would have its Lyman edge fall about here, and this one about there, so it's not very useful, and this one here about in the middle. So their proposition was that this Lyman edge Lyman alpha system at redshift of 1.486, it happens, would have its edge here, and presumably they were thinking with converging Lyman lines and so on, it would explain this drop. The interesting thing to me, and this, here is the bend polarization data, and you can see this one point is up. The raw data, less severely bend, is the dotted lines, and I guess you can see those. It seems to show pretty well in projection. And you can see, of course, there's a lot of noise, but you can see that it kind of shifts up here pretty much as close as you can tell, coincidentally with that drop in polar in flux. And so one could easily wonder whether that's a coincidence. If it is an intervening edge, that's a coincidence. What it would in that case mean is that you should correct this upwards for that absorption. The polarized flux would then go up, and you would have an emission edge in polarized flux at that point. Instead, you see a drop in polarization, which sensibly is of a similar magnitude to the increase in, I'm sorry, a drop in flux and an increase in polarization. And that is in fact reminiscent, as my colleague Bev Wills, not for this object, but she suggested for these polarization rise QSOs in general, the fact that even several years ago when we were starting to discuss this, we were aware that the broad absorption line QSOs have an increase in polarization in their troughs. Now, these objects are all unique individuals, but some do and some do not. But I think the most common pattern is when you go through the continuum and you go into these big wide absorption troughs, you see the flux drops, though not to zero, the polarization shoots up in that trough. And you can see that this is going up toward about 7%. So a polarization rise of that magnitude is, which is similar in magnitude to this object, happening within the apparent within the observed absorption feature, is what's at issue here. Okay. So could this be a similar thing?
Kind of mentioned that it seems that that intervening explanation is ruled out by the line.
Yes, I'm getting to that. Yeah. So, first of all, if it was an intervening system, this would be a coincidence. The polarized flux would then be jumping up in the edge. But I started looking at that, and I have my calculations indicate that you get into trouble with the behavior of the Lyman lines. If that drop is an intervening system, the optical depth is what you see, is what you get. You have presumably 100% of the source is covered. The depth of that absorption gives you the edge. That gives you the hydrogen column density. The Lyman alpha line itself is consistent with that, but it tells you the line width, the Doppler parameter, which is a reasonable one. But the higher Lyman line, it should be on a very flat curve of growth. The behavior of the higher Lyman lines, Lyman gamma and so on, their optical depths are dropping off in a way that is not consistent. Furthermore, I estimate that you should, the Lyman line, higher Lyman lines should converge only quite close to the edge. And it would not be dropping as, it would not fit the shape of that drop. It would not come down as soon before 9-12 angstroms subject to that redshift. So I don't think that works. It would be too sharp and too close to the Lyman edge wavelength for that redshift system. If you then tried to piece it together with those other several redshifts, I'm concerned it still won't fit the shape, but it's starting to get contrived now because you usually don't even get one system in a given quasar. So then for a long time I was interested in the idea of an intrinsic Lyman edge, perhaps just because we're all assuming this is associated with the Lyman edge. That would require still associating it with these Lyman alpha lines, but now assuming that it's ejected material. It would have to be ejected at about 60,000 kilometers a second from the quasar. The Doppler parameter for the Lyman alpha line is still about 25 kilometers a second. And high velocity but narrowish lines are seen, but nothing that extreme. Those velocities are seen in a few cases. In mini balls, they're called, that are 1,000 kilometers a second wide, but I'm not aware of anything approaching that velocity. So I set all that aside and worked on other things until I was made aware by, again, Gulli, a student at Penn State, and his co-workers, that at a different redshift absorption system in this same object, they have found a system with what appears to be a highly aluminum-rich quasar, absorbing cloud. And I don't know, with time moving on, that I want to deal with that in terms of showing the spectrum. I've got it here for anyone afterwards. But basically, they see only a few tens of kilometers a second apart a cloud that shows no aluminum but does show silicon, and a cloud that shows similar silicon lines and strong, equally strong aluminum lines. And they interpret that, with the benefit of photoionization models, as an aluminum to silicon abundance anomaly, which is a little suggestive of the BAL QSOs, where there's been great turmoil over orders of magnitude abundance anomalies, and then possibly no, there aren't, and so on. And without getting into all that issue, it just caught my attention. Whatever the interpretation, the pattern, the observed pattern of seeing lines that should be weak in terms of normal abundances instead rival the intensity of more abundant elements, their absorption lines, caused me to wonder if some intrinsic absorption could be going on in this object. But that would still be a rather narrow line profile, a very narrow line profile. Well, for that redshift system, it is a redshift system with what looks like pretty normal intervening absorption lines, normal widths, okay? So maybe that's what it is. But just at this time, Gordon Richards, a student at Chicago, and collaborators, came along with some statistical arguments that in luminous quasars, lots of the narrow, high-velocity absorption line systems that you thought were intervening galaxies are in fact ejected from the quasar. I've again got a figure here, which I can perhaps show afterwards to get us out of here in time. Half. Well, all right. Yeah.
Okay, why don't you go through your...
The issue, their argument in a nutshell is that you see more systems at a relative velocity of like beta of 0.2, but over a wide bin, in luminous objects than in less luminous objects. And the universe shouldn't know whether it's a luminous or a dim quasar behind it. So you get twice as many in the luminous objects. So even if all of the ones in the low luminosity object are intrinsic, then it leaves an equal number, all of the ones in the dim objects are intervening, then how do you explain the excess? The excess, at least,
well,
has to be... Well, they're aware of that issue, and they've obviously tried to deal with it, and you can assess the papers... on Astro PH, you can assess the thing. Anyway, nevertheless, I estimate that there are similar problems with the higher Lyman lines, equivalent widths, and the convergence to the series limit that make it hard to fit the observed equivalent widths and the observed shape of that drop in this model. So this has caused me really quite recently to retreat to the old idea of a broad absorption line. So we go back to the spectrum here, and we now raise the possibility that this thing is simply a broad absorption line. I'm not certainly not an observer or even a theorist who concentrates on BAL QSOs, but if someone had shown me that figure and asked me what that thing was, and I was told that it's not an intervening Lyman edge system, I would have said, that kind of looks like a BAL. So it's not a crazy thing. Once you assume it's a BAL, then the polarization rise is a perfectly natural thing. That's what BALs do, and they do it to about that degree. So it's an interesting model. The trouble is, it's not a BAL QSO. There are not noticeable BALs. There's no carbon 4. I've had this shift of heart so recently, I have yet to thoroughly go over the optical literature again to see whether there's a hint of N5. This, however, from time to time in discussions, this little feature here, which happens to fall where these Lyman alpha lines are, I was wondering if that was some kind of a hint of a BAL trough. Well, all right, first of all, I got ahead of myself. This wavelength corresponds nicely with the Neon 8774 line, which is listed in Roger's discussion, which would fall just about here at the emission line redshift. But detached BALs are as common as undetached ones, so the idea there's a little displacement before it kicks in is nothing new. O6, the O6 BAL would fall about here, and there's some Lyman beta emission mucking up the situation. So the possibility that this is a weak O6 broad absorption line, I think, bears examination, which would be consistent qualitatively with the very high ionization level here. But you're still left asking, why isn't there stronger O6? You know, you always have strong O6 if you have a high ionization thing, unless it's not that highly ionized. You always have N5. You always have carbon-4. So where are they? Well, that would suggest that it's a very high ionization thing. And looking at some photoionization models by Fred Hammond in a recent paper, there is a range of ionization parameter where neon 8 is near its maximum abundance. You ought to get magnesium 10, which should be looked for, but it's a little off scale here. It's off the spectrum. It's, I forget how, it's like 600, 620, somewhere in there. It's mentioned in the Aroff paper. And so it raises the possibility of a very highly ionized thing, wind. Now that might please Norm Murray, who was at the workshop earlier, unfortunately not here anymore, who has talked about a disk wind model for broad absorption line quasars with the wind itself would have an extremely high ionization parameter. So the possibility of that we're in fact detecting either disk wind or some other very highly ionized BAL may be really a very radically different interpretation of this whole business from the accretion disk phenomenon.
Right.
Yeah.
One question and one comment. Could we go back to the slide where you showed the actual question?
Yeah.
It strikes me that the absorption that you're attributing possibly to neon 8 is very much broader than the perhaps 06 absorption.
Correct.
And quantitatively, what range of velocities do you require?
Yeah, assuming this is all neon 8. Yeah. You're wondering whether that's too broad for a single transition to be in terms of precedent. Yeah. So that's 10%. Yeah. So, well, 30,000 kilometers a second is kind of the upper limit of what you observe.
Exactly. It would be like more 50, 2,300 to 2,000.
Yeah.
So that's like,
and you might also wonder, and I don't know whether this possibly a hint of something else coming in, but I don't know if that's the only transition involved, you know.
Yeah, well, Roger, you looked at what transitions are farther to the blue. Is there somebody else to pick up the slack there, to make
it.
630.
Yeah. 630? Yeah. I've got hard end.
Which would be in this range of ionization.
Sorry?
Which would be in this range of ionization.
Yeah, they're high ionization. You want to have some.
Is that the magnesium 10?
Well, it wasn't the magnesium. I think it was an oxygen minor.
It was 630 from 774.
Yeah.
It would definitely be at 625-30%. It wouldn't quite. It wouldn't quite be in the spectrum,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they have to be the similar transition to the highly polarizing. So not only do they have to be high ionization, they also have to be the distinctive transition.
Right. Yeah. The second comment is that in order to make that kind of ionization range thermally stable, you probably also need to filter the ionized spectrum.
Okay.
Which you don't like to do.
Yeah.
But get another semi-special requirement
to put those together. Yeah. Well, this is a new tack I'm taking, and I just haven't had time to pursue all that. Just to show you one example, here is a BALQSO. Not all of this is attributed in their model to neon 5. This is just the right wavelength for the phenomenon. You can see it going up and then maybe even trying to come down again. Which you might be tempted to say is like this, but those are some lower ionization stages there, and if you had those, why you wouldn't have carbon-4 in the optical, I just don't know. So I don't want to pursue that detailed analogy. But anyway, so where would you go with this? If this holds up, it would be, you then have the question, how do you interpret it? The standard model for the rise in polarization in BALQSOs is that you have a Miller-Antonucci type scattering region of considerably larger size than the main continuum source. the outflowing material gets in the way of the continuum source, obscures your line of sight, but the scattered light sneaks around it geometrically. So the scattered light is strongly polarized. So in the trough, what light you are still getting is the scattered light, and the polarization goes up. A nice model ties into other things we know about AGN, but in that case, I don't think it has much bearing on the other polarization rise QSOs, because they do not have any noticeable BAL type absorption feature at the wavelength of the polarization rise, which, by the way, is substantially similar, but the observers say not exactly the same from object to object. That is fine as far as my toy model is concerned, because it depends on things. It is probably okay in terms of neon 8, because, you know, you have detached BALs that set in at different blue shifts from the emission line red shifts. But still, it's not clear that it would change the picture for the other objects. If, on the other hand, it is the line scattering model, where Roger and company have argued that just the line scattering process in these resonance lines is a polarizing process. It depends on the quantum numbers involved in the transition, how strongly polarized, and I guess some are zero. But this one is, I think, what did it come out? I forget, is it 0.23 or something? It's not as strongly polarized, the neon 8 transition, as electron scattering.
I think that's
so it's a quarter as strong as the electron scattering. Okay, but the point is, in that model, even if you were looking at a different viewing angle down here, where the disk wind or whatever it is, the flow that's doing the scattering, is not obscuring your line of sight and producing an absorption feature, you still are in a position to observe the scattered photons, which could be polarized. And therefore, it perhaps raises the possibility that from other lines of sight, the scattered photon removed from the trough, if you were looking from that direction, are shot out in other directions and we're seeing them, in which case the possibility of polarization and polarized flux setting in without any associated absorption trough is now on the table. And so that would be an interesting phenomenon, which might conceivably be an alternative explanation for all of these objects. It would unfortunately undermine the idea of learning much about black holes from them, but it would be good in any case to examine that model now and decide whether it's the right answer or not. Okay, that's all I have.
Okay, let's see. Now, I'm sure there'll be further discussion. Don't go away. I want to mention that Kevin Rauch has done some visualizations of photonics near a black hole, and I'm going to drag in the TV projectors or the TV set,
great,
so we can see that after we're done working over what Greg has presented.
I'd like to know about these abundant anomalies and possibility of nearby absorption. Call it directly.
Well, this is really for these observers. So how are we going to resolve these different models of observation? Just a matter of, do you have enough objects to do these tests on, or do you have just a bunch of flaky objects that you hope you've got some signal on?
There are three others that have, like, I'd say at least four sigma rises in P below the Lyman at about this way. But one is the Zimby, and the other three were R. And, but you don't learn any much detail. There's only a few sigma. So, I mean, the obvious next step, since the Space Telescope doesn't have a polarimeter anymore,
right,
is to do the high Z ones from the ground. And it's not that hard.
Okay.
I think I was saying that the lip would be fine, I think, for this, because you're looking for gross effects. I think it's pretty easy to do with lip for the, you know, the brightest 10 or 20. I just need a volunteer.
And that's 10 to 20, which actually counted as absorption.
Oh, no. No, you have to relax that criteria.
That's my serious problem.
Oh.
How you mean?
It seems to me
you've got maybe one interesting object and another one you don't quite understand, and then the rest is nothing. So what are you going to do?
I don't know. I'm being like attacked,
but I'm also trying to say, is there another way to find these objects?
Is there any other property that correlates with having a polarization feature?
Like outbox looks good.
Or I don't know. Something on the S-ray spectrum.
One thing that could conceivably be worth looking at is this, that if this has to be edged on to get a high polarization, then it can't have much of a dusty torus, which means that it should be weak in the thermal infrared. It would be easy to look at that, and if by some miracle that's the case, then we know how to find more.
How many of you looked at, with everybody? You looked at hundreds of objects?
At the level of errors of plus or minus 2 or 3%, then I can include some of the ground-based stuff.
Yeah.
Then the grand total would be about 15.
If you buy at least one popular view of the geometry of DAL, which the absorbing stuff is more or less in an equatorial wedge, and if you demand that to get polarization, you have to be looking near the plane, you've got a problem if they aren't DALs.
That sounds a little model dependent, though.
I don't know.
Another thing that could be done to pursue, by the way, and which I think we're doing, but I think that we're attempting to get a position angle on 1630. We have with Gallimore and all got a few radio quiet quasars that we're doing, and I'm sure we have the sense to put that one in there.
You realize that theoretical models cover both positions.
Oh, I know.
Well, on the issue of search criteria, if Roger's picture prevails, then you might expect in terms of, say, carbon-4, I don't know what the quantum numbers are for carbon-4. Is it going to be polarized like this?
Well,
it's not zero. So some of these other lines at longer wavelengths, you might see, look for some polarization on the blue side of lines like carbon-4 in non-BAL objects, because if neon-8 can do it, generalizing from 1222 to the other objects, if we say they're ones where you're not looking through the flow, then some of the other lines at longer wavelengths that are easier to do might provide a search criterion.
I guess another search criterion. I shouldn't have been so dismissive of finding intrinsic edges at high Z. It's hard because of the force, but there are some that turn down there, and I followed up some of them to see if they were consistent with atmospheric edges, and the signature of that is no Lyman lines, at least possibly no saturated Lyman lines. So, with the IUE, the beauty of this was, when you found these possible edges, that there was no way to tell if they had Lyman lines or not. That's why they remained candidates instead of rejected. But from the ground, what one could do is either ask Seidel or get out that old Seidel, Sergeant Boxenberg, and pick out all the candidates, which I think we went through this exercise once, and identify those for which there's no saturated Lyman lines. Because that's pretty special, actually, to have a Lyman edge of something that looks like a Lyman edge without any associated lines. It's got to be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's plenty of abundance of scope. That was the other thing. It's very complicated. I went into this a little bit of the process. Because it may be saturation effects, all sorts of things. But if you get plenty of abundances, maybe that's a possibility.
genome is it maybe an output somewhere?
Well, okay, so the way I'm taking this question is, in the non-BAL objects, is there any way to pick out candidates to be a polarization rise QSO?
I certainly have never seen any.
And so then you'd be talking emission lines, and so the question is there anything in the emission lines? The funny abundances, one of the issues is aluminum. So if you wanted to pursue the funny abundance thing, you might want to look at the aluminum emission line in comparison to silicon and carbon.
Now, I think we all understand that it may not be a funny abundance.
Correct. Maybe saturation effects.
Yeah, which I think may be rough.
Yeah, I do too. So it's not clear that that's...
We're not recommending that as serious as a major thing to look for.
You're right. Yeah. By the way, X-rays were mentioned. A preliminary estimate just based on the absence of 1222 from the Rose-Sadol sky survey and some pointing that was, you know, 2,500 seconds as opposed to 600 for the all-sky survey, and the absence of the object from that suggests for such a bright object that it's... that it has a low X-ray to optical ratio, which is consistent with BAL QSOs as a group.
Lower than QSOs in general.
Yes, that's a very that's only based on Richard Mushatsky having that subjective impression when I put the question to him. Needs checking. But again, whether that would carry over to the other polarization rise quasars that don't have the absorption trough. I mean, that's attributed to absorption at a column of 10 to the 23. And that's getting to be pretty well established. It's not clear that would be the case in these other lines of sight. So one doesn't know if that's really a criterion.
Radio quiet might also be a supplementary criterion.
So, as far as I know, all of these are radio quiet objects.
Yeah, but that's not... they would be, because if you want to have a lot of flux at a given Z, pick out the radio quiet one.
Sure.
Okay,
it seems as far as you've got X-ray observations, I think that's
I agree with Keck if you want to put these additional criteria. Lichtenstein sure could do the brightest 20. But if you want these additional criteria, then you have to give up a couple more magnitudes probably.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Further questions?
One is perhaps not to get too hung up on one ionization parameter, because looking along the line of sight, you could be sampling a variety of ionization states. Mm-hmm. And the second is when you try and do theoretically the resonance scattering model, look at the predicted unit polarization, we identify sort of five factors, as it were. And one that's quite important is the kinematics of the velocity field where you're doing the scattering, because that affects the transverse escape, and that can be quite a big effect. You know, can sort of mess up the atomic physics prediction. But probably the best way of ruling out the resonance scattering and making the world safer accretion disk modulus is probably looking for the atomic physics signature of the polarization.
I mean, from transition to transition.
Yeah, but that is, it's very clear from the quantum mechanics which lines are highly polarizing and which aren't.
Right.
Just looking for that pattern, the anomalies and stuff. And if you fail to find that pattern at all, then...
But you have to see multiple polarized lines to do that in the first place, right?
You've got to see more than one.
If you have, let's say, some uses such as DNA or some other polarizing line, and if there's some other line that should, where the ionization space should be there with neon 8, but is unpolarizing scattering, that would be the cleanest.
Right. Yeah.
There's a slight, there's a, maybe a question for Cloudy is, can you get all this neon 8 without a little oxygen 6? Because there's no signature there.
Yeah, well, the Hammond models were with Cloudy, and I was, frankly, I find it a little surprising, because if you're just starting to go over the high ionization side of the neon 8 maximum, the 06 by eyeball looked like it might be down as much as 1.5 orders of magnitude in abundance. And then you buy, I mean, in fractional abundance, you buy back half an order of magnitude in the abundance of the element, and then I don't yet know what the oscillator strengths do.
It really hurts it.
State
in that ionization state raises the thermal balance unless you really tune the ionizing spectrum. You're probably going to have to really cut it off at energies that would ionize neon 8.
That assumes it's radiatively cooled?
Yeah, that's right.
Because
I mean,
that's not.
You can supplement it if you have some strong adiabatic effect.
You think it wants to run away to a higher temperature?
Yeah, and when you, if you're stripping oxygen down to helium-like, then the cooling function just takes a nosedive.
Can I ask the panel a question, just sort of an educational question? We sort of grew up thinking that nature abhors, you know, 10 to 6 degree gas, but there's a lot of interstellar medium volume that's 10 to the 6, and there's, you know, solar wind and so on.
And even more intergalactic medium.
So, but why, for example, is there an interstellar medium component? I mean, that maybe because of density. Tell me that, what is controlling that, the heat balance in that component of the ISM?
Okay, I'm talking about the tradition. In the ISM, presumably there's shock heating, and the ionization balance is controlled by collisions.
Okay.
So then the temperature is just a result of whatever the shock speed was and subsequent history.
But it's relatively cool, but it's still as comfortable at 10 to the 6.
Yeah.
Well, you get about half that.
Yeah.
Half that.
Yeah. And it's an issue of how rapid. What's the typical last time since you slammed the gas with a shock of 300 kilometers per second? The difficulty in the photoionization scheme is that ISM chamber continuing to ionize the stuff. It's an ongoing process. It's not an instantaneous thing that happened once in the past. And under those circumstances, it's just very hard to find a regime in which it will stay at that temperature.
Okay, I suppose we take
Greg.